Welcome, friends of the Libra Solutions Network. My name is Gabriel, and I'm here to inspire and hopefully educate others into building a better digital future. Today's talk, which I'm very excited for, is about digital autonomy and open source intelligence. Digital autonomy is the positive vision of what we actually want out of a better digital future. We want privacy, we want security, we want control and insight over our digital lives. And open source intelligence, which I like to think of as independent reporting, but sharing your work. And so I have really the best person that comes to mind to discuss this topic is James Corbett, founder of the Corbett Report, published author, notably a YouTuber, which is very relevant to this conversation, and most importantly, a very prominent open source intelligence researcher. Hello, James.
Hey, Gabriel. Thank you very much for having me on. This is an important conversation, so I'm looking forward to it.
Right. There's many areas I want to touch on. First and foremost is your long experience as an independent researcher. And one of the things that has really drawn me to a lot of your work is you really do walk the walk. I see you experimenting with decentralized platforms. I see you, you know, really spending the time to make sure your RSS feeds have the media, and you really doing almost everything possible to not only get your work out there, but to make sure it's as censorship resistant as possible. And platform censorship is a big part of the discussion, but you also do a great job sharing your actual work in the investigative side of things. And you've published many excellent documentaries, which I'm sure involved a lot of really nitty gritty investigation. And so I'm curious what you'd like to share about that process. What is it like to be a James Corbett researching for a documentary, putting out the next piece, really getting to the facts that matter?
Well, you know, there, it does go hand in hand with what you're talking about with regards to the process by which I do what I do is an important part of what I do. And that has been baked into the cake since the very beginning, that tagline for the website, which is no longer there on the website, in the newly redesigned website, but was there from the beginning. Open source intelligence news was not just some random stew of words that I cooked up. It was a specific deliberate choice that I made from reading a Washington Times article from 2006 that I used to have linked up in the About section. Maybe I still do in the About section of my webpage. That was specifically at the time I remember reading that, and they were talking about the CIA's OSINT, Open Source Intelligence Network, and their agents that were devoted not to James Bond sleuthing and spying around the world, but simply reading newspapers, listening to radio broadcasts, watching television reports, and of course, in the internet age, getting information from the internet. And as they were talking about, you know, more than 90% of the actionable and important intelligence that we get is from completely open sources. And it really struck me at the time, well, okay, yeah, of course, because there is a lot of information out there. If you know what to look for and where you're looking and why you're looking at it, there's an awful lot of information that's out there that's collectible. And certainly not one person, not myself or anyone else, can put that all together. But this is the internet age, and this is the great time of all this incredible decentralized collaborative information gathering and intelligence sorting and all of this. Why don't we do that? Why don't we become like the OSINT agents of not the central intelligence agency? How about a decentralized intelligence agency, not working for any particular government, but working for the betterment of humanity in terms of finding information, putting those dots, connecting those dots, putting the information together? Why can't we do that? So that was a founding part of the Corbett Report ethos. That was what I wanted to do. And as I always say, if nothing else, if I could just encourage more people to sort of operate along those lines. Hey, here's the information I collected. Here are the sources I collected it from. Do with it as you will, but this is the way I put it together. That, to me, is the model that I want to see in the media that I'm following. And I'm always delighted to note, I made note of this, for example, I gave a speech at the FOSSA conference, which is a free and open source software association in France. I gave a speech at the FOSSA conference about a decade plus ago about open source journalism and what that means and what it can mean. And as I pointed out in that lecture, you know, back when I started this, back in the mid 2000s, you would go to the New York Times, you know, website or LA Times or whatever it was, some mainstream behemoth, old school dinosaur journalism website. And on the web version of their articles, there was nary a link to be found. They would not hyperlink to anything. They would write about a government report, but you better believe they would not link to it. And it was sometime in the 2010s, 20-teens, when they started to regularly actually link to information. And I certainly don't think I had a decisive factor in that. But I hope that the idea of just, hey, you can link to this source. It's the internet. You don't have to just, we don't have to simply take your word for it because, well, the New York Times editors would have fact-checked this carefully. So we can just trust them. No, link to the report if you're going to be talking about it so that we can read it for ourselves. It's a simple thing, but I think it's incredibly important in this information age we're living in because, yeah, why should I trust James Corbett or the New York Times editorial board or anyone else when I can read it for myself?
And to me, that's a really important point, the non-hierarchical parts of it, because really one of the things that excites me the most in really the open web generally is permissionless innovation. The idea that somebody has an idea, they just want to start something and they just make it happen. And in many ways, the tools making self-publishing, producing documentaries, producing many of the multimedia content that you have done is a testament to the fact that we have a remarkable opportunity. Now, there are dark sides to this. The truth of the matter is, in many ways, we do have a bit of a, I believe it's a Brave New World type situation where many people aren't even looking in the right places. And I think it's a difficult balancing act between you want to overcome censorship yourself by making things available. But on the other hand, it's also up to the audience. I really liked your latest video about being unbanned from YouTube. And you were talking about how there are many people who, because you put something up about your book reportage, about how they had no idea you've been more than just a YouTuber over the last little bit, couple of years, I believe. And what's tragic about this is on the one hand, I definitely would, because I'm so used to all this. I listen to the Corbett Report on AntennaPod, which is a Android open source podcasting app, and that's my go-to way of doing it. But there are many ways to interact with these systems, and I even noticed the Corbett Report is on IPFS. That was one of the things that got me interested in IPFS as a distributed way of adding censorship resistance, but also sharing the load of sharing the content. And so I'm kind of curious, from your perspective over the years, platform censorship is one thing, but what do you think is the most important thing for independent researchers or even audiences to overcome censorship? What's worked? What hasn't? And I'd be very curious to know what you think hasn't worked over the last little bit.
Yeah, I think I have much more to say on that than on what does work, because if I had that magical formula, I probably wouldn't have suffered from the problem of people thinking I just fell off the face of the earth for the past 4 years because I wasn't on YouTube. And I do, it is difficult for me to swallow my bile when I think about the fact that I was warning people over and over and over, not just for a period of weeks or months, but literally years, something like a decade in advance. I kept talking about YouTube is censoring more and more. They will ban me eventually. You have to know how to access this work in any other way. And then when I disappear, people just think, oh, he must have retired. No, I did not retire. But it's easy for me to sort of dismiss those people and write them off. But actually, I just got an email from somebody in the independent media space who's a name that I know and respect. And I think a lot of people in your audience would probably know this person. And they admitted that it had happened to them, too, that they had they obviously knew about me and my site and my work. But once I was off of YouTube and I wasn't appearing in their feed every day, they started to forget. And eventually, and then suddenly, oh, you're back. Oh, right. James Corbett. So it happens to people generally. And I think that speaks to the incredible power of something that was pointed out by the master of propaganda, the man who wrote the book on the subject back in 1928, Edward Bernays. And in those stunning opening paragraph of that book, where he talks about how it is the people who manipulate the habits and opinions of people who are the real constitute the real ruling power of society. And that is it. If they can just get us into the habit of, well, this is my feed. I check my feed. If you're not in my feed, you don't exist. If they can get you into that habit, think about how carefully they can control your entire worldview. And that, to me, there's, of course, a lot of things we can point to with regards to censorship. But one of the ones that I think is the most subtle because it is not something that we see. It is something that we fall into, is the algorithmic manipulation. I'm old enough to remember back in the old days on Twitter, for example, when you would follow a bunch of Twitter feeds and your feed would consist of a chronological list of everyone you're following and what they've tweeted. But of course, that isn't how it is these days. Now it's a curated, algorithmically jiggered, oh, okay, you should see this and you should see this and you don't even follow this person, but we'll put it in your feed here. And it's like that on pretty much every platform these days. You don't just get to see what you're following. Of course not. And that is why, as I've pointed out before in my work on RSS, as I know you know, Gabriel, although exactly, not enough people know about it, the deliberate undermining of RSS that took place. And I certainly remember Feedburner, was it called?
Yes.
Everyone used that as a simple way to sort of RSSify your website or your podcast. It was an easy way, and it provided a nice handy graphical user interface that people could use to subscribe to your RSS, etc. It was wonderful until it, of course, got taken over by Google, who stopped updating it at all, shunted it off to the side, and eventually, of course, scrapped it altogether. Why? Because, of course, that is anathema to the big tech bros who want you in their walled gardens. And I'm loath to cite Jack Dorsey on any occasion, but he absolutely nailed it when he said one of the biggest wrong turns that the internet ever took, or that he ever participated in, was getting people to centralize content discovery and identity in these platforms. That's exactly right. That's what they've done. They've centralized our content discovery and our identity into their big tech monopolistic platforms, and thus have billions of people in their grasp. And they can eliminate people simply by, of course, eliminating them from your feed. They don't even have to censor you completely. It's just, well, they don't put your content in anybody's feed anymore, so you don't exist. That, to me, is the most insidious form of censorship.
Right. For me, the biggest problem with algorithmic feeds writ large is that space is by definition finite. Yes, you can scroll infinitely, but nobody's scrolling infinitely. There is, it may seem like it time to time, especially in mass, but the truth of the matter is that is prime real estate, especially when people are used to a single everything app. For instance, X is trying to position itself that way. But the truth of the matter is, I would actually say the old everything app was actually Telegram. I have my own criticisms of Telegram, but I believe the reason it's so popular is because it has channels that are interwoven with your chats. So the same interface you would use to communicate with your friends and family or other people online, suddenly you can also use that to get news and multimedia. And so, ironically enough, I actually think Telegram's fusion of social media and chat is itself a big bedrock foundation of everything app type architecture, but it also teaches us, in my mind, how much power technologists really have to build new systems. Like, the truth of the matter is, you can double down on decentralized technology. It just requires a bit of creativity. You're probably not going to get the same type of VC funding that always funds the greatest, hottest, newest thing. And one of the things I've seen over and over is that a lot of the biggest barriers really is accessibility. There are many great open source apps, but the truth of the matter is, somebody like me, if I develop something, maybe it would only be available for Linux. And that makes it hard because you're like, oh, well, if you're still on Windows, what's the point? And that's a big part of the problem here, is that it's hard to really bridge all these gaps. And there's a lot of choice in the matter, but I would really try to emphasize the opportunity in building tools for making these kinds of decentralized systems a lot easier to use. And oddly enough, I believe through the Independent Media Alliance that you're a part of, there's actually something coming out. Odyssey is building Portal, and I don't know if you're privy to any early information about it, but I'm curious what your thoughts are on that and what you see in the future in this space.
Yes, it's an intriguing development, and you know about as much about it as I do, assuming you read the Odyssey press release. I'm not, I think it's Ryan and Whitney and Derek that are really handling that and interfacing with them. I understand it's coming in the very near future. I know they've already made a press release about it, but I don't know exactly what this will be exactly. So I guess we will see exactly how it functions. But it's certainly something that, hey, as you say, at least trying to develop new things. I must admit, when I saw what was happening with YouTube and read the writing on the wall and knew that there was very little time left, I cast my wet net widely, and I was trying to put my stuff on a bunch of different platforms because why not? Although I thought at the time, probably my preferred platform at that time was the library, which of course developed into Odyssey, but Odyssey was always, of course, the web front end of that.
Exactly.
They had the library application, which was not censorable, or at least not in the same way that the web version was, and that you could access directly the blockchain, etc. So that was an intriguing idea, and it worked until it didn't. And then, of course, we saw what happened with library and the SEC. And
precisely.
How that, yeah. So again, it's an evolving thing, and people who are looking for that magic silver bullet, well, if it exists, it's going to certainly be under attack at any rate. So I think it's that's part of the frustration of this. Well, YouTube works, you know, it just works. And I need the, you know, automatic translation because I'm Swedish and I don't speak a lick of English, but I want to follow you, James, or that whatever the case may be. So, it's always an arms race, I think, for various platforms. And we'll see what Odyssey is developing with the portal thing. My philosophy has always been just competition. Let all the platforms fight it out. And I don't even think let the best one win. Let the best many win, because why does there have to be one platform where we all put all our eggs? I understand that, but actually that speaks to one of the most common feedback I've had over the years. Why don't you guys just all have one website where we could just all go? And my response to that is always, okay, who are you guys? Because your you guys are going to be different than absolutely everyone else's you guys. And it's almost like, wouldn't it be great if you could just select who you guys are and you could put them all in, I don't know, a feed reader and just automatically get all the updates? Wouldn't that be a good, oh wait, that system exists. It's just nobody knows about it.
You know, it's funny you mentioned that, because at least for RSS, there is OPML, which is a file format. You can mass import a group of feeds. Mm-hmm. And I actually put one together for the IMA when there was an announcement of everybody who's in the Independent Media Alliance. And I actually have it on my site. I'll make sure to link it in the notes here, because yeah, why not import that? But the thing is that this is broader than really just RSS. This is broader to the wider ecosystem of people want a single home for everything. And one of the things I actually reviewed somewhat lately is Greyjay. It's an app developed by Futo, which is intended as a place where, you know, you follow people, not necessarily what platform they're on. So it has this really interesting plugin system. That's what really drew me to thinking about Greyjay, was because you could, in theory, write a plugin to support any website. It started with YouTube, Rumble. I believe it has BitChute, Patreon, a couple of others, Nebula as well. It has many different video platforms. And so the idea was that you would only need to update the plugin to support the site, which is pretty handy, truthfully. Mm. It's very interesting how they've developed that application. And there are criticisms people can make of it, because the challenge with using a tool that is just a different front end for, say, YouTube, for, say, Rumble, for all these other platforms, you still have many of the same problems, because you're still on their infrastructure. And that seems to be a big point of contention with this issue, is that if people need the accessibility of everything being on, say, big tech infrastructure, you're fundamentally right that those days are dated, no matter what, you know, fancy jigging we do on top of that. And a big part of where this comes from is that YouTube is actually going a level further, where there was this prominent Linux YouTuber who does very, like, non-controversial topics. He just talks about Raspberry Pis, you know, and what you could build with them. And he got his video removed about Jellyfin, which is a self-hosted version of basically your own Netflix-type system. Mm-hmm. And it's tragic to see that the sad truth of the matter is that people inside the Panopticon are not going to be able to hear not even how to get out, but, like, there's stuff outside the Panopticon. You know? It's very insidious how all-encompassing it is. And to me, that's why I take this topic so seriously, is because your information diet, where you're getting your information from, what are its influences, all of those are really crucial parts about how you see the world. It's very tough nowadays where people want to, you know, think that, oh, I'm a critical thinker because I follow the right people, I memorized, you know, the right politics and these kinds of things. And it's very troubling to see that I actually think critical thinking is dying in some ways, because the digital tribalism is so strong these days because people are forming teams. There are basically roving gangs of people who want to online vigilante justice each other. And that's a very difficult environment to navigate. And so to move, you know, platforms aside, I'm curious on your thoughts as far as honestly, what are many very contentious issues? How do you navigate? Well, really what's real? Cause you know, everybody's biased. Everybody's got, you know, their slant on things. And so in your reporting, what are the tools you think are really important to get to the root of what matters?
Well, this brings with it a lot of assumptions and unstated sort of underlying axioms that perhaps bear interrogation themselves. And I've attempted to do that a few times over the years. I am very clear that I do not think there is such a thing as objective reporting. I think that that is a mask. Objective journalism is essentially a type of game or charade that was invented and played by the mainstream dinosaur media of the 20th century, really, as the mask that they would wear. We are the serious journalists who are telling you, you know, we're telling you both sides and you decide. But that was always an invention and really, I think a mid to late 20th century invention. If you go back before that point, journalism was always, always heavily biased and heavily slanted. And it always came from a very singular point of view. Especially if you go back, for example, in the American Revolutionary era and you're looking at the pamphleteers, they were definitely people who had a point of view who were advocating for specific things. So when did we get this idea that journalists are just sitting on clouds and have no subjectivity themselves? Obviously that's nonsense. And of course it was told to you by people like Walter Cronkite, who people trusted as the voice of reason, who by the way was also the voice of the owl in Bohemian Grove presiding over the cremation of care ritual and also getting awards from Hillary Clinton as, you know, for the globalist association or whatever that was called, and talking about how, well, if being a globalist means I sit on the right side of the devil, all I could say is join me here. Whatever that speech was that I've cited a few times. Those are the types of people who were the objective journalists who were just telling you like it is, right? No, obviously. So I reject that whole framing. I think the most important thing is to understand and incorporate the biases, the slant, the individual perspective, to give a little less derogatory phrase to it, of the people that you are following. Because I certainly come from a perspective. I have my own opinions. For example, I am an advocate of human liberty. I am a voluntarist. I am for decentralization of power. I am anti-statist. I have my own perspective, which obviously is going to, I won't say, because it's difficult to talk about this in a way that makes people think, oh, well, this guy's just being dishonest. No, we are all just being honest with the way that we see the world. And I am accurately trying to represent that. And I'm accurately trying to represent the facts that are in front of me. But of course, even what I choose to talk about is of course going to be influenced by what I'm interested in, which is going to be influenced by my perspective and the way I see the world, who I choose to talk to versus I don't have time to talk to that person. All of these things come from an informed perspective. So to my mind, the idea is not to move to some sort of ideal objective state. It is to know the subjective state of the various sources that you're following and to understand how that will influence their reporting. And once you do that, you can filter it then through your own personal bias / perspective, because we all have them, and see how this information is or is not useful for you, which is, I think, at the end of the day, what it should all come back down to. I am truly vividly aware of the fact that the more that we make this, the information space and alternative media generally about people, about this guy or that guy, or I don't like what she says. I don't like the way he talks or whatever it is. The more it's about individual people, we lose. We lose at that game because then it just becomes a high school popularity contest. It has to be about the information. And for each person, I think that means, is this information that I am experiencing from this podcast or this video creator or whatever it is this useful to me? Is this doing something positive in my life? Even if that is just, hey, it's fun, mindless entertainment. I need some fun, mindless entertainment sometimes. That's fine. But if it is not actually useful to you in some way, then what are you doing with it? Why are you engaging with it? And I think so that we all have to bring our own individual perspectives into what we're looking for in the first place anyway.
Well, a place where I really feel that is the fact that there is a huge difference between understanding something and putting it into practice and having absolutely felt the lessons that you're trying to learn. You know, it's all well and good to theoretically understand how to resist something or how to work towards something, but until you start putting it into practice, you're not going to realize how different that actually is. When the rubber meets the road, things can get all wonky in all kinds of ways. And you hit on something that's really important there in the information landscape, which is putting people or even organizations on a pedestal. In your opinion, how much have you even experienced that personally? How much have you seen it really corrupt the space? Because when it comes to people versus people, there definitely are observable alliances, observable, let's say, friendships and heartbreaks that you see. I'd be very curious to have your thoughts on all of that.
Yeah, well, again, we are all humans, so the human drama of it is going to play into it, no matter what it is. And, you know, to some extent, again, you can't really avoid that. Some people just like the way certain people talk or the way that they present information. Some people hate it. And I recognize that's not a, I mean, again, there's nothing you can do about that. It is a thing that we have to just accept. And so I've, you know, for example, I'm well aware there are people who love the way I talk and the way I present information and people who hate it and people who are in between. And that's fine. But that's why my message has always been more about, okay, great, whatever, whether you like me or hate me or whatever, I don't really care. But if this information is useful to you, why don't you put this information out to your friends, family, whatever? Hey, you start a podcast, you can do it, and you will reach the type of people that you will reach because you speak and you present this information differently than I do. And that's virtuous. I don't think of that as, oh my God, competition. Oh my God, no. No, I think of that as a good thing. More people, more voices in the mix is in and of itself a good thing. So the human drama side of it, yes, I mean, it just gets wearisome to me. I was never interested in that ever. So I guess I, you know, I'm just perhaps individually, subjectively, I'm just not the type of person who's interested in that, generally speaking. But I do tend to follow the dictum that, what is it, great minds talk about ideas, good minds or average minds talk about events, and simple minds talk about people. And I think that's about right. So when the conversation is all about the individual people and their personalities, I realize generally that's the time for me to tune out. I don't think I'm going to get anything of value or relevance from that.
Well, many of us went on the internet to get away from all that. It's funny how it comes back with a vengeance. There is something definitely to
well,
that.
I think. You know, that's something actually, honestly, that's a genuinely important insight because I certainly do remember connecting on the internet back in the 90s for the first time and what a wildly different place it was than it is today. And obviously so, because every website basically that you went to was just some completely ridiculously individualistic expression of some weirdly niche interest that you can't imagine someone, you know, is so incredibly devoted to whatever, you know, train toy hobby, you know, sets or whatever it is. And they have this whole website with all the like flash animations. And it was wonderfully quirky and silly and amateurish. But of course, with the homogenization and the centralization of content discovery and identity that Dorsey talks about, with the Facebooks and the Twitters and the YouTubes making everything standardized so that people can't even customize their MySpace channel like they used to. It has drained all of the individuality out of that. And I did write about this in an editorial that I'm not going to remember the name of the top of my head, but I did write about that wonderful, quirky, weird, stupid in sometimes and zany, but intensely human internet that used to exist, the World Wide Web as it was decades ago, and versus the corporate soulless dead internet that so obviously exists today.
Well, I'm noticing a bit of a renaissance of that, not in the same form, but there are a lot of people who are playing around with static site generators. And static site generators are great because it saves somebody a lot of the handiwork of writing the entire website by hand. You just enter in some markdown and it generates you a site based off a pre-selected template. I went far enough to try to figure out how I could build my own template. Very interesting learning experience, I'll say. But the thing and that's a point I made, instead of saying using WordPress or another content management system, I'm like, I've got to join this revolution, make the Liberal Solutions Network and my personal website an expression of that. And I've interacted with many people on what I kind of shorthand call the independent web. Many people have different names for it. But the fact of the matter is that I would say this is something we do need to fight for. We absolutely need to fight for a space where people can kind of just express themselves. And it's hard because I would argue now is probably, there's definitely something that's been lost from that era, because now that people are so, you know, politically at each other's throats, now that, you know, many, I would say almost modern weapons have been, cultural weapons have been pined and reformed that like create a scenario where it is harder to speak out publicly now than I think back then, because at least I remember from my childhood, nobody thought the internet was real. The internet was something different that wasn't part of real life. And what's changed between then and now is that the internet is real life. In some ways, it seems more important than the real world, which is terrifying. Yeah. Yeah. And it's a big part of the reason why I like your documentary series, The Media Matrix, which touches on this in a big way. And just to tie a lot of these concepts together about how the web is under attack, how people put things on pedestals, and how the information landscape is polluted, I think it's really important that we get to really the point of this, which is where I wanted to talk about your response to the IMA panel on AI. We need to talk about AI, and I absolutely think we need to, partially because AI is something that is absolutely put on a pedestal and people will take it face value. And so I don't necessarily want to make you recap this video and the IMA panel, but I will say it is worth checking out and listening to, because there's many important concepts and questions about what AI is, how should we use it, what are the proper boundaries we could set. And part of the reason I asked you to have this conversation is because many of the previous installments of Digital Autonomy and the Arts, I have talked to many artists who are actually in the minority in their field. They are, let's just say, not as opposed to using these tools as, let's just say, many artists out there would have you believe. And you're definitely somebody on the other side of it. You pointed out that using these tools is in many ways advancing the agenda. And so one of the things I wanted to hear first when you mentioned that in the panel is, what agenda are we furthering by using these tools?
That's the question, isn't it? Which I will always go back to and cite Neil Postman and his questions we should ask about any technology. He gave that lecture. He wrote about that back in the 1990s, and it's as true today as it was at that time. With any new technology, we should ask, what problem is this new technology purporting to solve? Because once we put it in those terms, we might see more clearly that perhaps we don't need this technology after all, which to some extent might be the only way forward with certain technologies. There may be certain technologies that the only winning move is not to play, to quote War Games there. So AI might be one of those technologies. Now, let me be more clear than I was in the IMA panel at that time, talking about digital art. I don't think that using digital tools to create art is necessarily negates the concept of art, or that it is not possible to have artistic expression using digital tools. However, specifically, it does rankle when I hear from people who have created and they wrote an AI song by prompting Suno or whatever people are using these days. Hey, I want a country song with these lyrics, and it pops out a song, and hey, I wrote this song. No, you did not write that song. And I don't think of that as a valid expression of human artistic endeavor, because it is not. You did not come up with that. You don't even understand how to play an instrument necessarily, and yet you're prompting some LLM or AI monstrosity to garbage, essentially regurgitate a mishmash of songs that it has been fed. And I don't think that that is a valid expression of human artistic creativity.
Well, my biggest fear when it comes to AI, and I've written about this a fair bit, is that regardless of how, where people choose to use these tools, I think there's kind of like an embedded psyop. And you see this when people will say, oh, if you don't use this, you're going to be left behind. There is a lack of an appreciation for building your own craft, whatever it is. It could be all kinds of different expression. And to me, this is very concerning in this specific space of open source intelligence, because I see a real attack on independent researchers by the basis that people believe these tools can do research when actually, oddly enough, it's kind of got the Trump administration had some egg on its face. This is thanks to New World Next Week, you and James Evan Pilato did, where the MAHA report that was put out by the Trump administration did the classic AI blunder. They cited citations that
studies that don't exist. But don't worry, it was just a formatting error. Somehow the formatting created these studies of real researchers with these studies that they didn't write. No, sorry, well, I never wrote that.
I've got to make a bold statement here. I actually believe AI is the new pandemic psyop, basically. It is that all-encompassing. It is that distorted, that extreme, and that contrived, because, for instance, we're already seeing AI mandates at work. The Shopify CEO said, you have to do things with AI. You can't hire another person on the team unless you try it with AI first. And I think, to rewind a bit, an important part of this conversation is when we say AI, what are we talking about? In many cases, there's a wide range of technologies, and they're kind of like all incestuously mixed together, because, well, that's how you can build things on top of each other. And to me, I kind of put things into two major categories. One is I call things power tools. So, for instance, there's like in the video, I'm using StreamYard right now, and so there's a machine learning algorithm filtering out my background so people don't see my messy computer room. But the thing is that that's something that's like in the background. And there's a more nefarious side of that, where you see many of these social media apps will have video filters to make you look more, say, conventionally attractive. And to me, there's an important line here between, say, a small cosmetic difference and something that can alter your own self-perception, how you see yourself. And that, to me, is the terrifying aspect of these technologies, is that they can absolutely alter people's perception, even on very basic things. You see this with the text generation AIs, where it's like, oh, I asked Grok this. Grok, is this real? You know, you see that all the effing time. And it's tragic. It's terrible, because there's this problem where AI is on a pedestal. And part of this is because it has access to so much raw information that no person is going to ever like read or come across in their lifetime. So it looks very intelligent. And it's frustrating, because lately it has been really hard to have a conversation with people about the limitations of this technology. Because if you say, hey, it's just trying to predict the next token, it doesn't actually understand things, they'll be like, oh, you're just a Luddite, you don't understand. But hey, Apple has a paper here saying, no, it actually can't reason. And to me, it's frustrating that it's like there's this cargo cult mentality that AI just is what the people building it say it is. And we kind of have to just go along with it, or, you know, completely disconnect from it. And I do think what needs to be disconnected from is the dependence on their infrastructure. So, for instance, let's just talk about ChatGPT here, or Grok, same kind of idea. You have a chatbot that is connected to their data systems. It's recording everything you say, whether you send it images or documents, however you feed the information. It's saving that on its own servers, and then it's outputting a response. To me, that is radically different than somebody, say, downloading a model and then using a program that, say, open source, we verified it's not doing anything crazy, and running it. Because to me, what an AI model fundamentally is, to oversimplify a little bit, it is a fancy list of numbers. The model itself, to me, is not sentient. It's not magic. It's not, you know, anything. It's just a brute force pre-calculation of numbers. And so the problem is that I'm worried that a big part of the hype around AI, it has been to push people onto this infrastructure, the consolidation of we're all using these big servers, and that's the problem. That's what gives them all the power. That's what gives them the ability to manipulate and control people. And so specifically, what have you seen in this space when it comes to AI use as far as the pressure? Do you see researchers being pressured to use it, even though it has these unintuitive limitations?
I don't know about pressure so much as incentivization, because there seems to be, I mean, again, people always want to chase the clicks and do whatever is trending on various social media platforms. And I've certainly seen the trend in recent months, last year or two, of all sorts of people saying, hey, I asked Grok about this and it said this, as if, oh my God, well, it must be true. Oh, Grok now thinks 9/11 was an inside job. Well, actually, no, it just agreed with you and sort of fed back your own information in a way that is designed to keep you engaged with the platform exactly as it is designed to do, right? So yes, I think the real danger to this is, as you say, on the mentality of the people using these technologies rather than the technologies themselves. Specifically, the sort of the audience capture of people using chatbots, and the potential for a her-like scenario playing out in the future where people really do start to replace human interaction with this algorithmic interaction. Because I see this ultimately sort of long term as playing into the twin agenda, we'll call it, interrelated but not completely the same, the technocratic agenda and the transhuman agenda. And I think that there is a concerted effort to break down the barriers between organic sentient life and non-organic computational life, as it were, silicon life. And I think we are being prepared for that. And then also, of course, we are being prepared for algorithmic governance of various sorts. And the more that people can blindly trust, oh, it's AI, so it knows everything, and it's the Godhead, and we can ask it anything, and it will just tell us the truth. It's the perfect technocrat. Because let's break down the technocracy idea. Again, as I am at pains to stress, technocracy is not simply about technology. It's about rule by experts or people who present themselves as experts. And obviously, the example from the past 5 years was the health technocrats that presumed to rule over the entire, all of human activity, because they were the health experts and they were going to tell you how to, you know, how they can protect a grandma. But as many people were arguing at the time, well, look, whatever Fauci does or does not know about health, and that's questionable at best. But anyway, even if he was the supposed expert that he says he was, he's certainly not an economics expert. And he's not going to be able to tell you in great detail about the incredibly important knock-on effects of shutting down the world economy and forcing people into their homes and all of the effects, economic and health and otherwise, that follow on from decisions like that. Again, it's the sort of the myth of expertise generally, that there is one solution and one answer and there's this one truth. It isn't about trade-offs and knowing the differences between things. No, there is one answer. And that's exactly what Eric Schmidt said in his interview with Charlie Rose several years ago, where he was talking about, no, Google gives more bugs than per second than anyone, because anytime it tells you more than one search result for your search, well, that's a bug. It should tell you the one thing that you need to know, and it should know what you need to know, and it should present it to you. Well, that's the dream of the technocrats. They want to completely control down to you just ask a question, you get the single answer, and you believe it unquestioningly. You don't have to think about anything. Completely and totally displace any idea of cognitive sovereignty or your ability to reason or think about trade-offs or any sort of nuance. No, there is an answer. And so now, of course, we're being presented with the idea the AI has the answer. So why don't we make them in charge of government, as Joe Rogan and others are openly talking about now?
And the slope to that is incredibly slippery. One of the things I'm noticing is that when it comes to AI, there's a mythology around it. You know, there's, for instance, you talk about undermining human, you know, capability, essence, and all this other aspects to it. When people are trying to say, hey, this thing isn't sentient, they would say, oh, well, what is reason anyways? What is consciousness anyways? There's kind of this weird nihilistic mythology around this. And it is a lot of incentives aligned in particular directions where I have a feeling that there are not many consequences for being too pro AI. For instance, Nobody Special has done a great series on YouTube about AI mania, talking about some of the financial corruption. And I think that greases a lot of palms. I have a feeling that if you're right now, you know, there, it's really easy to create a new startup that just does something with ChatGPT and say, oh, we're this company with AI. And we see it invading all these different domains. And that's kind of where it has this bizarre omniscience quality to it, where it's like, oh, we can do this in everything. And yes, machine learning has absolutely fascinating applications in really narrow, refined spaces. But the idea that we can restructure technology around this advancement is a trap fundamentally. To me, when we try to take from a starting point, oh, this thing exists, therefore we need to reorient society around it, should really raise everybody's eyebrows. Because, for instance, one of the things I learned from your documentary about oil is that the way society kind of revolutionized itself around oil could be seen as a political decision. And so I think we're kind of seeing the same kind of thing with what we are told is AI, but it's probably a more specific application of tools. And I think it's important to make the distinction between something that is a technology and an implementation. There is a specific thing out there that does exist and has problems, regardless of the theoretical benefits of the technology. And so when it comes to the omniscience of AI and it's applying in all these different domains, there's this really big problem where, again, to go back to the Maha report situation, you have people in these institutions who have real power one way or another who are leaning on these tools, but how are they being provided? Where are those tools getting their input from? How are they cleaned? You know, many people will say, oh, this AI is less biased than the other. They're all downstream of the same fundamental idea of we're going to collect all the information and use it for the greater good, whatever we want to call it, you know. And how do you think this is going to affect power dynamics? Because to me, what this looks like is they're building that new mainstream. We had the objective mainstream back in the journalism days of like, oh, this is the objective truth. And now, oh, AI must have the objective truth because can you really disprove it?
Yeah. We can't trust Walter Cronkite, but we can trust Grok. No, that is where we're heading. And it really does come back down to that same mentality that I think appeals to certain people's common sense intuitions that they're, yes, it must be true that the more data that we can have and can collect, the closer we will get, be able to get to that singular, the truth, the singular answer to any question. So if we could just collect all the data on everyone and everything and feed it into this algorithm, what we'll call the AI Godhead, it will tell us. It'll tell us everything. What happened, what's happening, what's going to happen. It will just know everything. It will know the universe. And I think that is essentially the, whether people know it or not, I think that that is the assumption, the underlying assumption that they're working on. And I fundamentally disagree with that entire mentality. I don't think that that exists. I don't think it should exist. I don't think that we should be striving for the collection of all of turning the entire question of the world and the universe into numbers and data that can then be fed into algorithms and we can get predictive results from that. I don't think that that is the way forward. If people want to get very philosophical about it, I would recommend they read Heidegger's essay on the questions concerning technology, where he talked about the drive towards the scientific methods drive towards creating, turning the entire world and what it is and what the world that exists and distilling that down into what he called standing reserve, as in there are all these elements and chemicals and materials that can be used and manufactured and produced and combined in various ways for certain productive ends in the material realm. But once we reduce the entirety of the universe down to that, well, that is the only type of answer that we can get. And we can't ask questions that are beyond that realm. And that starts to, you know, that really has some profound implications about what even is humanity going forward. What is the point of the human enterprise to the extent that that exists? Or are we just information collectors? And if that is so, if truly what we are doing is creating the AI Godhead, then all we are is what people have talked about before. We are the messy, ridiculous, organic life that is bootstrapping the silicon intelligence that will go on to populate the universe. That we're just sort of, you know, the intermediate species that will be gotten rid of and should be gotten rid of because the silicon life will be superior. And I don't know. I'm team humanity. I don't know about you.
Yeah, I mean, it's sad that the idea of people creating their own stuff, mastering their own craft, feels, without AI, feels like a radical thing, a radical choice these days. It sounds like such a line in the sand. You know, even myself, I spent a few weeks just trying to draw a little bit every day. And part of the motivation behind this, actually, oddly enough, was that I'm on my own journey when it comes to personal growth and weight loss. And the thing is that a big part of that is realizing putting things into practice is its own experience. And that's valuable, yeah, regardless of what it is. But there's this thing, and so I kind of made a little cute little post about it saying, I'm learning to draw to spite Rocco's Basilisk. And have you heard about Rocco's Basilisk, James?
I don't think I have.
If you've heard of effective altruists, which are, mm-hmm, I would say, yeah, the AI cultists, you know, hive mind fundamentally, it's a quirky, yeah, group of people. They were centered around this message board called Less Wrong. And there was this concept, and it created this big drama on the forum where somebody introduced the concept of Rocco's Basilisk, which was fundamentally this idea that there will eventually be this AI godhead that is so powerful that it will be able to simulate your consciousness from the dead and punish you retroactively. And, well, as a religious person, it's funny to see the parallels of that. But anyways, the fact of the matter is that this created the community to go nuts. There was a full, like, censorship tier response to this. They're like, this is a dangerous idea. If people hear about this, they're responsible for it. And to me, that's a really, like, early example of the predictive programming around AI. People are told a story and they're kind of slotting themselves into it. Where do I fit in this story? And I saw an amazing summary of this, like an even shorter summary of this story, where somebody made a tweet or a post somewhere that said something along the lines of, like, tech nerds came up with the biggest boot they could imagine and decided that it needed to be licked. Like, this is really what Rocco's Basilisk fundamentally is like, let's imagine the biggest boot. And what's fascinating to me is that the boot is not the technology. It is not the artificial intelligence able to simulate you. It is the technocratic fascism that this kind of technology is being used for that will punish you, not retroactively in a time travel sense, but how many people right now are being punished because they didn't go along with, you know, the COVID narrative? How many people are being punished because they're not going along with this bold new direction? I think what's kind of happening is that there was a message sent to these people fundamentally that there is an opportunity cost to not being on side with this. And it's funny to see the alignment on these issues.
It is, isn't it? So, sorry, how does that tie into your drawing?
Oh, sorry. I said I was drawing to spite Rocco's Basilisk, an outward defiance to the idea that there is something that will punish me for not spending all of my life energy creating the godhead. And I think that's an important way to approach this question, because it's very frustrating to see people buy into this idea and then live their lives based off it. And I think there are non-obvious ways people do that. When they say, like, not to throw shade, but you mentioned in the IMA panel that Patrick Wood of Technocracy.news said, oh, if you're not doing this, you're being left behind. And the question is, what are we being left behind from? Are we being left behind from being, you know, lobotomized and turned into digital circuits? And that's life now, like you say, the synthetic silicon life?
You know what?
Life?
It's just occurring to me now. Maybe the way that we need to frame it, because so much of these conversations ultimately get determined by what appeals most to sort of common sense, salt of the earth truisms that people tend to go along with. So we need that on our side. And here's one that everybody has heard a million times and they know to be true. There's a difference between information, data, and wisdom, right? We all know that, and we've all heard that a lot, and there's various applications you can think of about it. It's the difference between reading about how to ride a bicycle versus actually riding a bicycle. And we all know that, the only way you can actually know how to ride a bicycle is to do it. You can't really read a book about it and understand it, right? We all understand that. Maybe that's the way we need to frame it when we're starting to talk about these things, because that is the world that we're heading into where, okay, let's imagine even the AI godhead really can do at least some of what is being claimed about it, and it really will tell you whatever information you need to know. Still, all that relegates you to is just this sort of lesser slave to that information who you do not have the actual real world experience to do anything with that information other than what you're being told to do. It's the difference between going to some AI music site and getting it to compose a song for you and learning how to compose a song. They are very, very different things, and they will give you a different experience of the world and will inform you differently. And you will be a different human being if you learn, for example, to play an instrument or whatever the case may be. Whereas you will not be a different human being if you ask AI to do it for you and it does it for you. it just seems so obvious to me that one of the things that clues me into the fact that we're not dealing on a rational level here is that when I raise these types of concerns, the vitriol, the anger of some people who I think are particularly, individually implicated in what I'm saying. Like, well, I use, my chatbot a lot and it's a good thing. Damn it. And you're just the rage, the almost demonic energy that this evokes in certain people to me is a good clue into the fact that we're not really talking. We're not having a rational conversation here. There is some sort of deep personal investment that some people have in this that I think we have to crack that code if we're going to find a way to stop people from falling off of this technocratic cliff.
I can really empathize with that because there is a learned helplessness that can develop when people are unable to do things, when you don't experience that riding a bike yourself, when you don't do things and lose the opportunity of being able to engage on a real fundamental level. And it's a bit of a trap because once you're there, you don't know you can do things. And so you feel less empowered. And so everything's hopeless. And then you get kind of stewed in that. And I think that's kind of by design. I think it really is by design that people are being ushered into this direction of using these tools that do disempower you. It's already shown that when people are relying on them too much, it does lower their rational capabilities in many different domains. And I won't say that that's entirely deliberate, but I do think it's oddly suspicious that over the last few generations, we've seen this consolidation of really ability to do things independently that has gotten very difficult, which is why I'm a little worried that many people will kind of blame the victim all the way down. Like we're going to have many people who are growing up in school systems where this is from start to finish. You're going to, the child will grow up with the AI and they won't know anything different. I think for those of us who weren't in that environment, it's our calling to really reach out to those people and say, hey, here's how you can try something simple without all this nonsense. It is terrifying to me that people inside the panopticon are not going to be able to appreciate what being outside of it is like. And these lines are so blurry.
You know what? I feel like that just being so grateful that I was probably the last generation to grow up pre-internet, right? I had a childhood that was not online, and that, that is, I now understand that to have been a blessing. Wow. I at least understand. I know the world before we were all connected 24/7 to our devices. People growing up these days will never have that. And so they cannot possibly understand what the natural non-online world is in that sense, because as you say, the internet has become more real than the real world in some ways. And I think that applies to this AI question as well. And as you're talking, it just occurs to me that it's one of these things where people are so interestingly able to compartmentalize their arguments and use them against or for certain technologies, even if they're contradictory. So whenever I talk about cryptocurrency, my chat, at any rate, is always 100% filled with people. But if the Great Carrington event happened and we lost all electricity for the rest of human future, you wouldn't have those Bitcoin now, would you? Good point. You got me there. Well, actually, you could do it with paper. But anyway, you got me there. But for some reason, it's like, but then when I argue against the use of AI, or at least the unthinking use of AI, well, we got to have this. Well, but what if there was a Great Carrington event and suddenly you couldn't use AI anymore? You didn't think of that one, did you? It's funny. Right. There's always these sort of prepackaged formulaic responses that people have various technologies. And another thing that you said that I'm definitely going to steal, because thank you for giving me a different way of saying it. I always talk about baby and bathwater when talking about, for example, crypto, the utility, the potential utility of cryptocurrency versus the specific instances of it. It's technology versus implementation. And that is we need to start concentrating more on that because, it's not the technology. It is the implementation and the way that we make use of that technology that's the real problem.
And I feel very strongly about that. I had you had me on Solutions Watch to talk about digital ID. And to me, what's fascinating that kind of brings this together when it comes to technology discussions, why doesn't our side, why doesn't the freedom movement have 20 digital ID prototypes before the bad guys, so to speak? Why do we not have our side really doing the experiments, figuring out the edge cases, figuring out the security concerns? To me, one of the big pillars of why I do this is I do want to encourage technologically minded people that we can actually innovate without permission from the system. We can learn programming languages. We can build tools. We can, you know, do all these things that if we spend the time learning, we can build things that matter. And the fact of the matter is, you see,
you know what? That's a valuable perspective. And I need to explore that more with you and like-minded people, because I'm not sure that I agree with you, but I'm not exactly sure why I disagree with you. But I know, for example, I talked to Ernest Hancock, Freedom's Phoenix, a lot, and he is always talking about, I want, how does he say it? I want Jarvis, not whatever.
Ultron.
Yeah. I want my personal, you know, decentralized, I run open source version of the AI, whatever. I don't want the, you know, the outside version, the Alexa kind of stuff or whatever. Like, I get that perspective. But to directly contradict what I just said, maybe it is sometimes the technology, not the implementation. Maybe there are certain things that I just think we should not go down that road at all, like digital ID. But then again, we are in a digital world. So yeah.
To defend that point, because one could assume I'm on default on the other side of that. But the thing is that I believe when we say, what is a technology? You know, to me, AI is too broad a definition to really say, oh, AI as a technology is good. Yeah. To me, there are specific techniques. For instance, the image generators tool, those use diffusion, which is a mathematical construct. And to me, the problem is that when you align these systems in such a way that they do things for you, that is in one way debilitating, or in my opinion, when it comes to the chatbots, you automatically empathize with this system no matter what. And so there are boundaries we need to have with whatever systems we use. You know, if somebody says, oh, I have Jarvis and not Ultron, I'm like, well, if you have the same enmeshed life with it where you're still not having any proper healthy boundaries, you're basically in the same system. And I agree with that because, for instance, you know, the AI girlfriend discussion, you know, just because your AI girlfriend is free and open source, that doesn't mean you're living a perfectly happy and fulfilled and connected life. Yeah, you know, that's a real solid point there. And that's why, you know, fundamentally, when it comes to the innovation,
my girlfriend is free and open source would make one hell of a bumper sticker. But yeah,
I'm sure it exists. but the thing is that to me, it's such an important point that, like, we should be able to have people on our side who innovate, and innovation is good. But at the same time, we have to guide it with an idea. We have to have an animating vision. And that's a big part of the reason why I started the series, because I wanted to connect people with from different domains, because us tech guys, we kind of get in our own heads, you know, a bit. We have this technocratic idea of, oh, we know best because we've played with all the toys, you know, whatever. But fundamentally, I specifically chose to first reach out to artists because there are people who at least have a, by default, more human-to-human connection. Visceral Venture is, you know, theater, and Liam's a musician. You know, there are so much that can be done to really connect people together. And I'm not just talking about fake connection. You know, I'm not talking about, oh, if we're having a, you know, video call like this, this is real connection. Yeah. It really is about setting the proper boundaries. And I think the problem with the boundaries is that people are taught by default that their boundaries don't matter. They're, whether it's their workplace, we can inject what we want with you. You have to use the AI, whatever the mandate is. Yeah, and there are real powerful incentives driving that. And I'm going to say that it's very easy to be like, oh, well, the people falling for it are just, you know, the problem or whatever. But I'm like, we need to figure out, our job innovating is to figure out, how do we realign those incentives? How do we, from the bottom up, change those habits and opinions of the people? And I think that's what open source intelligence is about informing our approaches. Because if we don't spend time, you know, kind of supporting James Corbett's and people who are spending the time to do something different and really inform us about how we should approach things, of course we're going to take what's easy. Of course we're going to take what's right there before us, or the false binary of two different options that are definitely the sum total of everything we can do.
Yeah. And just to offer the opposite of the black pill here for just a minute, you know, I wouldn't be here talking to you. I wouldn't exist, at least in this online form that I do, if it weren't for the support that I get from people. So it can work. It can happen. I don't know exactly what particular secret sauce of, you know, how that happens. And I don't know how the James Corbett of 2025 would do what James Corbett of 2007 was able to do to build up a platform. But at any rate, it is possible. And I think that is, I mean, that is something, you know, it's not nothing. And I certainly appreciate the sentiment. We need to support each other, because you better believe that the they, them, those are not interested in supporting us.
That's sadly a very important point. Thank you, James, because I think this has been a great conversation. I really hope we've kind of drawn some guideposts that people can have, you know, thoughts and discussions about this for. Is there anything else you'd like to leave us on, either specifically on AI or your new book, Reportage?
I would just like to let people know my new book exists in case they don't. It's called Reportage, Essays on the New World Order. It is available now wherever fine books are sold or ordered by ISBN number. And you can find out all about it at reportagebook.com. It's a collection of 20 essays on all sorts of matters, geopolitical and philosophical and historical and otherwise. And I think some of what we're talking about today certainly does intersect with that, although maybe not the AI question in particular, but I think the question of human freedom and what it means and how we can go about trying to claw a little bit more out of the hands of our would-be rulers is definitely one of the key themes of the book.
Well, the best part about having the book is the AI can't rewrite it, which is going to be an increasingly big, important concern moving forward. So thank you so much for joining me. It's been a pleasure and an honor to have you on, and I look forward to what people say and what kind of a response I get to this. So thank you. And
excellent. Thank you, Gabriel, and keep doing what you do. It's important work, and I hope people will support you too.
Thank you, James.